Welcome, everybody. This is Dave. How are you doing?
Hi. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. I have some excellent questions that you've asked, and I've kind of adjusted a bit this seminar to incorporate them because I think they best fit during this seminar, and that includes some about confidence and some about story busting, and I want to include both of those sort of wrapped in the context of this seminar. So rather than just sort of give you what would be my answer right now, I want to incorporate them in the material, and I think it'll fit and flow better in that way. First, let me mention that I'm going to have to be away next Monday, so we're going to have our final class 2 weeks from right now rather than 1 week, and I hope that works okay with your schedule. I apologize. It wasn't something I was aware of at the very beginning. I'll send out an email to remind everyone of that. So for right now, are there other questions or comments that you'd like to discuss before I move into the material and incorporate some of the questions that you've sent in? And I appreciate those. Anything right now? Okay, well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode. I usually raise more questions than I answer, so we're going to save some time at the end, and I promise I'll wrap in the discussion of the questions I have. And we won't exactly follow the outline that you have, so kind of hang loose for a little bit and bear with me while I begin in a different way, because I want to give you a quiz. There are actually two quizzes that I want to give you at the beginning that will kind of set the stage for something that I'd like to talk about. Okay, here's the first quiz. Wharton School of Business surveyed several thousand professionals to examine the major factor that determined whether someone engaged or declined services from the professionals. And the reason was the same in both cases, the same reason for declined or accepted the services of the professional. Here are the options: years of experience, reputation, amount of the fee, degrees and certifications, state of the economy. Just jot down what you think was the number one reason. Second quiz. Carnegie Mellon did a large study to determine the major factor for professionals earning the trust of others. Here are the options: established, proven expert, demonstrated current expertise, reputation, and esteemed credentials. Okay? Jot down the answer you think. Now, for both of these, it's none of the above. It's stating the recommendations and the fee specifically, clearly and confidently. Simple, confident explanations trump expertise. Mirror neurons and energy fields resonate with someone else's emotional state, their midbrain, and influences behavior. Now, I did this to set up the discussion about how we often look in the wrong place for answers. We look for where we lost something, where the light's better, rather than over there in the darker spot where we lost it. My racquetball coach had a great phrase for that. I was working with him to get ready for a tournament. I was playing competitively, and we have a deal where he freeze frames me, and he'll say freeze, and then he'll show me exactly what I need to be doing differently. And he froze me at a certain point. He said, "Okay, Dave, everything you're doing, you know, your stance, position your feet, your body, your backswing, everything is perfect, except you said in some part of your brain, this is a good place to hit the ball. So you were exactly where you wanted to hit the ball. Now, the ball, however, was back there a little ways." So he made a great point. I was exactly where I wanted to hit the ball, but that wasn't exactly where the ball was. Now, here's something that this relates to in a way that I think is really important and probably the most important state of mind that we can have as coaches. Confidence is a state of mind. We know from a number of neuroscience studies that emotions and states of mind are contagious. It's an energy field transfer from amygdala to amygdala, person to person. Einstein referred to this as the unified field theory. He emphasized that we're a bundle of energy and interact with another person who's also a bundle of energy, and those energy fields intersect and interact. The same with each person and the collective field of a group of other people. Confident is a state of mind. It's contagious. Confidence is more important than past accuracy or demonstrated expertise in earning the trust of others. People naturally associate confidence with expertise. We know now that confidence is a greater predictor and determinant of success than competence. An example, in studies with business school graduates, men initiate salary increases 40% more than women do. And when both ask, women ask for 30% less than men. At Manchester Business School in England, Professor Marilyn Davidson says, I've been doing this for about 7 years, and every year there are massive differences between male and female responses. The male students expect to earn significantly more than the women, and when you look at what the students think they deserve to earn, the differences are huge. So we have to look at our confidence and recognize that confidence is a state of mind that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I'm going to return to this because I want to talk about regulating states of mind and how this is the most, in my view, the most important success factor in dealing with professionals. Now, here I want to kind of insert a couple of questions about story busting and emphasize how important this is in our work with professionals and how this can be effective, and then talk about states of mind. Here's the backstory. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. Our plot, our core beliefs and assumptions, informs what we notice and how we process experiences. We then create narratives according to that plot, and a story holds together facts and relates information. In fact, we ignore facts that contradict what we believe. We only see what fits a recognizable pattern on our personal radar. So we believe not as much as what we want to believe, but what we expect to believe. Our brains and emotions are both programmed this way. We believe according to our self-image. Our views are self-statements of our perception. We also use logic and reason after the fact to rationalize decisions that we've already made, that our emotional brain has already made. And although we may see ourselves as principled, logic, and objective in sorting through facts, research demonstrates that we make decisions based on emotions colored by bias and belief. So we create a story often personalized to understand it. Someone's portfolio goes up with a market surge. Well, I think I'm pretty smart. People externalize the feelings they create and then see themselves as their victims. My anxiety seized me. My fear stopped me. These offer reasonable explanations. And a story moves through time. Each story contains a before, during, and after. Now, a cause and effect may be an explanation, or it may be a justification, a forced reason. So, in the absence of a story, we'll settle for a rationale. It begins early on. At six, we said, well, everything I do, you blame on me. We're each inside a story, creating it moment by moment. Every day is a blank page. It's not there until we create it. We have the ability to leave the old story behind by not continuing to create it, since it's not pre-programmed or written in our genes. This is story busting. But remember, when you're working with a client, that client is not talking about their current story. They're not talking about looking at their past story. They're telling you the way it is. We have to move to the position of the client seeing it as a story. That's what we talked about last time in the roadmap, a systematic way to deconstruct the elements of how a story is put together by our minds and brains and how to revise it or create a new one. So the brain creates the capacity of story to synthesize and integrate before, during, and after. The uniqueness of us as human beings is the capacity, the requirement for a story. So let's look at a couple of aspects of this. Planned story busting. In coaching, we listen for any one of these three that our client leaves out, before, during, or after. And a story without all three components is incomplete. If we write an incomplete story, we give up power. The incompleteness can begin with, I'll try, I should, I want to. Now, these individuals believe that story, but it's self-deceptive. So when you hear somebody say, well, I need to stop drinking, I'm going to try, I ought to, you know they're going to keep drinking. These stories are begging to be busted. Yoda said it best, try not, do or do not, there is no try. So a commitment begins with, I will. A commitment is a decision you only have to make once. Now, the incomplete story takes over the author, just as procrastination or relentless working. It can become its own seditious story, eclipsing its author's true self, or takes on a life of its own. For example, certain states of mind, fear, rage, anxiety, overwhelm, only engage the moment, the during, as a partial story. A hot stop tip, a business deal suddenly gone sour, a family tragedy, all trigger a similar alarm of mind. The impulse resides in the present moment. So, we ask, what will make me feel better the next instant? And the coach asks, instead, what's in your best interest? Or a client says, I'm really set and comfortable doing what I'm doing, but I wonder what it would be like to let go and try something really different. So the coach nudges, what do you imagine? Or how's it working to be aware of both uncomfortable and yearning, being aware of both comfortable and yearning for change? Or to later add, what could you do to become more comfortable with your passion? Now, story busting means old hope is gone. Story making creates a new current and future hope. So you'll need a new internal and external language that focuses on the present and future rather than reiterating the storyline. And to get your tenses straight, old story is past tense. But remember, a client does not see it that way initially. So that's the result of some work. In fact, experiences that form an identity, such as calling oneself an introvert, or I'm a bargain hunter, anything that someone does repetitively and then creates an identification makes it a little bit harder to change. Anytime you see repeated behaviors or habits as part of an identity, makes it a little bit hard to change. But this is story busting. In the first business presentation that John Gray, the noted author, did, he passed out. He used this experience to energize his quest for excellence, to begin a new journey toward mastery, to discover the gifted speaker he would become. So a self-defining line of memories tells us who we were, but it cannot tell us who we will be. Only who we will be if we repeat the past, and there's no future in repetition. So, in looking backwards, it's like Diane Ackerman's photographs tell us who we now think we once were. Or, as Larry Thompson wrote in Shine about now and next, he said, first of all, build and nurture relationships that fit your new identity, not your old one. So, if we attribute a storyline to inanimate objects, like the objects themselves have the capacity to create a story, listen to the unspoken, pernicious story attributed to each of these three quotes. Well, this stock has always treated me and my family quite well. Now, it's as if the stock had a mind of its own or even knew who owned it. Of course, which it doesn't. The most powerful force in finance is reversion to the mean. as if some ultimate authority is arbitrarily averaging numbers and creates a story or a force. And the third, the odds strongly suggest the Red Sox won't repeat, as if the odds have a storyline and speak it. Story is so powerful, though. Fairy tales show the power of story. Aesop gave such powerful explanation that we only have to code back to a single reference to evoke an entire principle of human nature. Sour grapes speaks to the inaccessibility and rationalization of failure. Another brief example. For centuries, no one believed a human could run the mile in less than 4 minutes. In 1954, one man busted that story, and the perception of reality and possibility changed. Within months of Roger Bannister breaking the 4 minute mile, in the next 18 months, over 12 people broke that record. Today it's commonplace. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. So, listening to and getting to know your story begins understanding the unspoken assumptions of hidden agendas and story busting of aspects that are outdated and non-productive. And too often we see ourselves as the victims of our stories or situations and overlooking the fact that we author those stories. We create those feelings. The limitations or the obstacles that seem to take on a personality of their own are really our creations. And remember, when you're ready to look at the possibility of creating the obstacle yourself, you're ready to look at the possibility of not creating it. So, just a couple of examples. Indirect story busting. Accidental story busting. The example I gave from the first seminar, I spoke of Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire and how when he asked people to do different things each day, there was an accidental story busting and they lost 11 pounds because they did something each day to recognize that everything they do, every bite they eat, is a choice. So when you change your behavior and experience, you change your brain. And change includes both creating a new experience and a new present model to understand that experience. So your identity changes along with it. Another aspect, incidental story busting. Here's an example. In a Harvard study begun in the 1950s, 10 to 15% of the Harvard Business School graduates fashioned a specific vision for their life in business. 5 decades later, those 10 to 15% had 90% of the assets of the entire group. And a final, self-busting stories. An example here is the addiction to extreme success. Success can be intoxicating, and this is especially true in professionals who you will be working with who have not had the experience of extreme success and are fortunate and successful enough to achieve extreme success. Here's an example of how success intoxication can be gradual. If a frog were placed in hot water, it would immediately jump out and survive. But if the frog were put in cold water and the temperature were to rise gradually 1 degree at a time over a long period of time, several days, the frog would ultimately die because of not perceiving the water as hot. Or in humans, one drink an evening may gradually lead to 2 on the weekends, and a pattern begins that because of its incremental nature, the change isn't noticed until some profound event brings it into focus. Now, with extremes of success, an accomplishment in business or athletic or artistic talents, the enhanced stimulation and self-reinforcing aspects of that success make it harder to regulate emotions and to stay grounded in values and identity. Exceptional assets like athletic ability, beauty, intellect, or wealth can eclipse developing other qualities as well. Because of a remarkable talent, for instance, such as an athlete or business ability, one can get so enmeshed in the pursuit to become lost into it. Each single increment, such as increasing the length of time at the office, is justifiable. It makes sense in and of itself. But then the big picture is gradually lost. The water warms very gradually. Each rising degree of heat can be dismissed by bargaining, rationalization, or distinguished by levering, let me say that a different way, it can be disguised by leveraging the present for the future, such as promising to take time off later, to kind of bargain with oneself. So I'm going to talk about some examples of professionals in just a moment, a few moments, who needed coaches not to become successful, but to stay successful. So, as we're talking about regulating states of mind, and this goes to your outline now, a state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and how we process information and how we respond. So each state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, and behavior patterns. A key element of coaching is helping a client become aware of various states of mind with particular focus on which state works best for what purpose. Here's an illustration of how states of mind are like different software packages. If you take a rat, put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the goal. It can go again and again to get the cheese. Now, if before you teach it to get to the goal, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, you simulate a stress-like state to create a slightly different state of mind. You can teach the rat, and it can go to the cheese again and again. Now, you take away the amphetamine, and the rat can't get to the cheese. It has in a part of its brain the information about how to get there, but it can't access it, and it can literally in that maze die of starvation. You re-inject the amphetamine, it can immediately go to the cheese. State-dependent learning, state-dependent memory. And that's like our states of mind are. Each state is very specific in terms of information, experiences, memories, but it's usually in such a fluid interchange that we're not aware as dramatically as the example I just gave. And we recognize how to enter and exit different states. Like it's important, for example, to become aware of what state to enter for a creative endeavor, like writing, or what state to enter for conceptual planning, or for critical thinking, like editing. So different states of mind used for different purposes. So to look then at this in a bigger picture, the access to mind states is really important in regulating feelings and states of mind and in understanding how we best work and for optimum performance. So let me give you some kind of extreme examples, but nowhere is this more evident than the regulation of states of mind with artists and writers, professionals of a different genre, who enter a creative state to do their work. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in a stale coffin as a prelude to enter her genre of mind to write her macabre literature. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and Diane Ackerman wrote on a pine plank suspended across a bathtub that had warm water and bubbles in it to kind of create that floaty feeling. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm so he could recreate that experience on canvas when he got back. Some authors play a piece of music repeatedly during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house their evolving story. Now, you think about how this works. The corresponding state of mind of the reader often matches with that of the author, because the author guides the reader to a particular state through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of the imagery, the rhythm of feelings. When you think about the most natural method that we have to regulate our state changes, begins with distraction, such as jangling car keys to shift a crying infant to a calmer state. And we each have various ways to distract ourselves and then to reconnect the mind and body, such as getting grounded in physical activity or a walk outdoors or a warm bath or working out or breathing exercises. People try to regulate states of mind in certain ways, even artificially, such as action symptoms to stimulate the body, like alcohol or drug use or symptomatic eating. So let's look at how to regulate states of mind. This is a crucial thing that we do to achieve success, to manage our emotions and regulate states of mind. So another little mini quiz here. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain, Philip Seymour Hoffman. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind, using drugs, alcohol, or some other substance to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions leads to significant compromise and an external reliance on something. Our states of mind, the particular software programs we use, determines the meaning we attach to a stimulus. The meaning we attach then determines our behavior. And that's a really important clue in helping someone to understand and regulate states of mind. The state of mind we're in determines the meaning that we attach, and the meaning we attach determines our behavior. Think about how you are in a very relaxed state, enjoying talking with someone you really like and respect, and it's dark outside, but you hear a sound. You probably don't even notice that sound, but you're home alone. You've just watched an episode of Criminal Minds, and you're a little spooky to start with. After that episode, you hear something outside, and you're startled or you're alert. So same sound, but different states of mind determines how you perceive that and then the subsequent behavior. So there are two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: physiology and focus. Physiology is how you use your body, and focus is what and how you focus on. So here are a couple of ways to think about this. With physiology, we may regulate a state of mind by relaxation or by breathing or some way that we focus our energy and the physiology to regulate that. The other is focus, what and how you focus on. Your power is in your focus. Two things determine your focus. One is the questions we ask ourselves. And a couple of questions we're always asking ourselves: what does this mean and what should I do? So whatever we focus on determines where our energy field, where our brain will begin to notice things. So if we have an habitual feeling that we don't like, it can come from an habitual focus, usually by questions, because questions, as you know from being a coach, is what channels and focuses the attention of someone, because their focus will follow your powerful question. So if we have something that we don't like and something we can't get rid of or a kind of rumination, we may be asking the wrong questions. You know, what can go wrong? Why does this always happen to me? Why am I overweight? So change the questions. Ask a better question for a better focus. Remember, you're always asking questions from the moment you wake up, although you may not be aware of it. So if you immediately wake up and ask yourself the question without even being consciously aware of it, what could go wrong today? You've already begun scenarios that establish a state of mind. So ask a better question. What will I create today that will be more powerful than I ever dreamed of and have fun doing? Ask habitual questions that empower you. Asking effective questions determines your state of mind. This is your powerful focus. So one exercise, and try this and see if it helps you determine a more powerful and more active and focused state beginning early in the morning. Write down three questions before you go to bed. Three questions that are empowering, that will put you in a peak state. When you wake up in the morning, as soon as you turn your bedside lamp on, before you really wake up fully, before you get up, answer those three questions. Remember, you're already answering questions that you're not even aware of asking, most probably. This just changes the focus to consciously engineer those questions to ones that empower you. Because the very first thing you do or think or feel in the morning is going to set your state of mind in motion for the subsequent time. Remember how when you've been preoccupied by something, it'll be the first thing you think of, and then you're in a state of mind that's not so great to begin your day, or you stub your toe, and you're in a state of mind and things kind of crescendo downhill after that. Or when you're in a really great state of mind and expect an exciting experience during the day, it kind of vaults you into a mood that you sustain for the next several hours. So consciously engineering that process by writing down three questions to empower you and put you in a peak state might be something that would be useful. I've used it with a couple of clients that it had a remarkably fast turnaround for them when they were going through things in their lives and businesses that were very preoccupying to them. So let's look just briefly at self-control and self-regulation. Now, self-control is conscious, willful intention with short-term goals, like push through this fatigue to finish the project by midnight. Count to 10 so you don't blurt out something angry. Or I'll go jogging this afternoon to really get into a more energetic state of mind. So the self-control, and it's something we coach about, but we may not call it this exactly, we establish intention, help someone set an immediate concrete goal, and focus on a short time range for a specific response. So that really is determined by focus and by immediate goal setting. Now, self-regulation is something different. It involves an optimum state of mind to access all the information in each of our different states of mind. So this is something that involves different parts of the brain. It's internal. It's emotional and cognitive. It's longer-term goals. I want to give you a case illustration and then some principles. My client was a moderately successful CPA who functioned brilliantly when he focused and became immersed in a specific task. He initially consulted me because he wanted to take his CPA firm regional from a local presence and develop a partnership program. His challenge was twofold. If there were external distractions, he got derailed and he had trouble moving from task to task, project to project through the day in a seamless continuity. And basically, we discovered that he had a kind of mild form of attention deficit. And that meant that when he focused, he did great. He was totally absorbed, but he had difficulty and used a lot of energy moving from task to task. So for him, self-regulation involved getting him to look at the big picture, to create a map, to create a weekly and then a daily schedule so that he had a map for the week and for the day that he could readily look at where he was. And what we did then was for his daily schedule, he learned to schedule blocks of uninterrupted time to sustain a state of mind. Now, the principle here is that it takes as much energy, we're told, as to change a state of mind as it does for a television to run for 3 or 4 hours. It takes as much energy for a television to turn on as it does to run for the next 3 or 4 hours. So the analogy is state changes take a lot of energy. So sustaining effort and sustaining the state of mind can be very, very productive. So we would schedule blocks of uninterrupted time to look at clustering activities that required the same state of mind to not be interrupted during one of the states where he needed to concentrate, such as by turning off his telephone, his ringer, getting his secretary to, his office assistant to schedule only interruptions with talking with people in his firm at certain times of the day, only returning calls at certain times of the day, and for him to write out tasks of the day in one-hour blocks and keep it on a post-it note where he could always see it. So we have to take into account what stimulates and motivates us in the formulation of goals, our biorhythms, and factors like fatigue, sleep deprivation, energy level, attention, emotion, all affect state of mind and therefore access to optimum mental functioning. Additional influences that can affect this: caffeine, alcohol, exercise. So this is where self-regulation is important, to recognize a broader plan that integrates mind, body, and spirit in a wellness mindset. So being grounded and centered allows a state of mind for optimum synthesis of thinking with access to existing knowledge. And stress can catapult someone into a state of mind that narrows concentration and limits the scope and range of thinking. The stress hormones of epinephrine and cortisol even block information processing. So this is a very real and important aspect of helping someone to recognize their own factors, their biorhythms, what they can do in terms of self-regulation, regulating states of mind for their optimum performance. When you're relaxed and centered, when you're really grounded, you have the greatest access to all of your states of mind, to all the information you possess. The antidote of purposeful relaxation extends energy reserves and prompts fresh ideas. After a period of relaxation, attention and concentration both improve. An example here that psychobiologist Ernest Rossi gives us, he suggests a 10-minute period of relaxation as a purposeful downtime that can enhance performance and restore brain functioning. He reminds us that these periods are not falling asleep or doing nothing, but a relaxation that can be, say, a visualization that can help someone go through a structured period of relaxation and engage, even activate the mind. So these are things that can be very beneficial in helping someone to find ways to regulate their own state of mind. In fact, one of the ways that you may find this manifesting itself in a session with a client, I've had this occur maybe two or three times, where someone has just had something really upsetting happen to them right before the call or the day of the call, and call in to say, you know, I just don't think I can use this period of our coaching today in the best way. I'd like to reschedule. Now, that's a very reasonable request, but it's also an opportunity. And I have asked in instances like this, you know, I let them know, I hear how upsetting this was to you. Would you like us to do, just for a minute or two, a progressive relaxation to help you get really centered? Inevitably, the person has said yes, and then we do a centered relaxation, a progressive relaxation that takes maybe a minute or a minute and a half. And inevitably, they also recognize that now they are able to make use of the session in a much more effective way than they had ever realized. And what we know as a professional is that this experience just provided a model that could be invaluable for this person, that this person just had the experience of experiencing and downloading a model of how they can come to self-regulate, of something they can use at any time that they may choose, because they've done it once so they can access it again when they're ready to do that. So let me talk for just a moment about self-regulation and the use of mantras. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage, lowest in their division nationwide. So during practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot, a 3 or 4 word phrase coupled with a deep breath for relaxation. He gave the example of relaxed and smooth when someone would step up to the free throw line, but emphasized that each player determined his own mantra. So the mantra was of 3 parts. One is the cue. He suggested that the player dribble the ball a couple of times as a cue. At the same time, they were focusing on the phrase, analogous to relaxed and smooth, and at the same time they were doing that to breathe in one deep breath of relaxation and one exhaling all tension. So in 3 or 4 seconds, they were relaxed and centered. Now, in addition to this, he simulated game conditions by abruptly stopping a player in practice and asking them to shoot 2 free throws. So this is the mindset of pressure in the game by suddenly stopping to shoot a free throw. Because in a game, you don't get to line up and shoot 30 free throws and count the best ones. So if the player made a shot, he got to take a breather. If he missed, he had to sprint around the court. In 2 years, the team was ranked number 1 in their division nationwide. So mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers that can instantly change a state of mind. And some of my clients who are pro athletes and actors have used it to get grounded and centered for their performance. And keep in mind that you'll need to be the guide for someone if you offer a suggestion like that, and keep in mind that, well, first of all, not everybody's going to carry basketball around, but that some people are not verbal. They're not auditory. So a phrase to focus may not be the best way. Some people are visual. I worked with a well-known person who was very visual. And as we talked about this and the 3 parts of the mantra, she immediately knew what she needed to do. And she was about to appear about 3 or 4 times in a row on Oprah. So right before she was to appear, she did her cue. And then what she did for her focus was to envision herself engulfed in a white light. And that white light was energizing and calming. And she did that for about 5 to 10 seconds before she walked out, and she was dynamite. It prepped her in exactly the way that she needed to do for this particular performance. So centering brings mind and body together for full focus. The principles have to do with getting centered and regulating states of mind, and then choosing to access the state of mind that is most useful for a particular performance or for a particular function. One example that I want to give that is a bit of a different nature is working with a client. I'll call him Nathan. That he had just written a New York Times bestseller, but he was stuck. He was in a slump, as he called it, a writer's block. He was stuck. He couldn't access the state of mind that he had engaged in to write his bestseller. And he was concerned that he would never be able to do another bestseller, that he was stuck, that he couldn't access this, that he was going to be a one-hit wonder. Decided to consult with me. And as I got him to describe frame by frame what he was experiencing and what his internal conversation was, it became evident to me, or almost evident, that what he was experiencing was not anxiety in an old sense of danger equals better head for cover, but anxiety that was really an excitement, a different kind of excitement than he had experienced before, because now he had the certainty that he had it, that he knew what it took to be significantly accomplished as a writer. And when he sat down, he experienced this kind of excitement, but interpreted it as anxiety, and then that anxiety stopped him. He stopped himself with that. So I shared my observation with him. It sounds like you may be having an excitement when you sit down at your desk to write, that you're reading as if it's anxiety and interpreting it in an old model. And we both knew immediately the old model he was referring to, I was referring to because we had looked at that in the past. When Nation, he confirmed this. He said, yeah, it is a different kind of anxiety. And we talked about then, when you read the excitement as anxiety, it puts you in your old story where anxiety equals danger. And in that story, distracting yourself was adaptive. It was a way of regulating the tension. Because that's what he was doing, sitting down at his desk. He started immediately to distract himself. The perception, coupling of meaning, and coping mechanism were part of his old story, but it was now being juxtaposed with this newly evolving story. And here's the key. This is a sidebar here, but it's a good time to emphasize. The key is that every time that there's a state change, that someone gets lost in the content of that state, but a feeling always begins a state change. Some feeling that is a cue or trigger for that state change, and then immediately you're in a fixed focus of an old software program that you can't figure or logic your way out of, even though you try and even though the content seems compelling to try to figure out. This is how a lot of people get stuck in therapy, too. The key here is to recognize the feeling to trigger that state of mind, to have it trigger a different state of mind, to, instead of being caught up in the old story, to use a mantra to get centered and grounded right now, in this instant, and to have the story that you want to enter ready and waiting. So for Nathan, this perception, coupling of meaning, and coping mechanism were part of his old story, but now juxtaposed with this newly evolving story. So he recognized his current anxiety as feeling different was an excitement. It was also an uncertainty about letting go of the familiar, but he recognized that he was misreading it. And when he read it as excitement, he could reframe his excitement as a validation of being in a new experience and reframe it as a signpost of progress to continue moving ahead in his writing. The result was he produced an even bigger bestseller and had fun doing it. So I want to remain the remainder of the time to reserve that for discussion, because I may have raised some questions that you didn't even know you had until you started listening. Hold on just a moment. I'm interested in your take on this, thoughts and ideas that you have, and things that we could be talking about that would be more helpful to you. Your thoughts and questions. If I could get everyone to manage the background noise, there's some things going on that your receiver is picking up. No, we have a fairly large group, so if you could mute *6 until you're ready to talk. Now, I interrupted somebody who was talking. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dr. Kruger, this is Susan. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
I'm great. I wanted to ask you to please give me an example of three questions before going to bed that are empowering and put me in a peak state.
Okay. Now, again, there's some background noise. If each of you, especially if you're on a cell phone or computer phone, if you would mute *6 and then unmute again when you're ready to talk. Again, there's some background noise. Please mute *6. I can go back on lecture mode, but I want to keep this engaging and conversational here so you can interrupt me if there's something that doesn't make sense. Some examples, and you'll have to do this specifically by knowing how you enter different states, what you're preoccupied by, recognizing that what you automatically may be asking without even being aware of it are things like, what's going to go wrong today, or, you know, how am I going to be able to afford this, or, you know, thinking about the things and the things that could go wrong. So think about the things that can go right. What can I do today that would be more empowering than I've experienced before? What is a stretch goal for today? What can I do today that I'm, what am I going to do today that I'm really going to have fun with? And I live by, it could be a mantra. My favorite grandmother said, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So what am I going to have fun? What's going to be enriching? What's going to be empowering? And to do these questions that would specifically look at a positive focus, not a negative focus in disguise. You know, how can I get out of debt? How can I lose weight? That's a negative focus in desire in disguise. Remember the principle from what we're talking about is from quantum physics, that our focus always follows our energy follows our focus. So what we focus on determines what we're looking at and doing. Let me take a couple of other questions and put us on lecture mode, because there's some distracting noise that somebody's not muting or not attending to. So, Susan, does that begin to answer your question?
Well, yeah, that is distracting. I'm trying not to pay attention to that slurping noise that's going on. So if I'm waking up in the morning thinking, what did I do wrong? How does this always keep happening to me? A different empowering question would be, I don't know, I'm stuck.
Well, write the questions down before you go to bed, so that instead of waking up with the usual questions, you wake up to those empowering questions, because you want to create a positive state of mind before you even get up and engage your day, because that will sustain you. That mood, that state of mind that you establish will sustain you for a period of time.
Right.
Yes?
Yes.
Now, so the questions have to be yours, but they need to be powerful, they need to be positive, and they need to be what you can actively do to effectively determine not only your state of mind, but what you engage in, especially in the initial part of the day. And it may be looking
right
at possibility, and especially possibility instead of problem.
Okay, so instead of saying, why does this keep happening to me, how would I reframe that?
What can I do today that would be empowering and fun? Because you're not going to be able to answer that anyhow, because why it keeps happening to you, the answer to that is not going to provide a new story. You're just re-entering an old circuitry. And every time you engage a problem, even ostensibly to solve it or write a better ending, you're creating a more deeply etched portion of your brain that houses
Correct.
That problem. So
Correct. I get that.
You want to look at possibility, and possibility put in a positive way that can be state-changing and enhancing, and look at setting a determination and a goal for the day that can, in the process, establish a positive state of mind.
So it would not have to necessarily be about the problem. It would be about empowering and having fun, which would divert the same pathway from focusing on the same problem.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
Because there are two invisible forces that shape us. One is our state. I'm gonna put us on lecture mode for just a moment.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know what that noise is.
There are two invisible forces that shape us. One is our state, and that determines momentary decisions, because it determines how we perceive and how we process things. And remember, our state determines how we perceive things, and that determines our behavior. This all happens by way of our hippocampus and our midbrain, and that's the place that any stimulus comes to our amygdala first, then to our hippocampus to attach meaning. That's where our unconscious resides, where meanings are attached. Then, once meaning is attached, it determines our behavior. So our state and our momentary decisions determine what we're going to do. The other is long-term, our model of the world. That's a force that shapes us. So we want to look at our beliefs, and if our beliefs allow us what we want to do and where we want to go. So this is what's important, and that's why I mentioned in the beginning that confidence is really a state of mind of how important it is when we determine our state of mind. We're also determining how confident we can be, and if we need to work on confidence, we need to work on a state of mind. Whenever two people meet, the person with the greatest amount of confidence will influence the other. And remember the two studies that I mentioned about the major factor in professionals earning trust, the major factor that determines whether someone engaged or declined services from the professional, is the confidence of the professional. So we determine how someone responds to us. We teach them how to respond to us. And confident is a state of mind. It's contagious, as I mentioned, from amygdala to amygdala. And it's a greater predictor and determinant of success than competence. So this is why I think it's really, really important that we be very aware of that as professionals. It will determine, if you have a client, it will determine the success that you will have with that client. So the first thing we need to do is to know our own story and to look at what works and what doesn't. We need to do story busting of ourselves, because a lot of our beliefs, our biases, our assumptions that are ghostwriting our behavior are ones that are automatically constructing our stories. So look back at the roadmap process. We just had the overview of that, but it's a way of deconstructing our assumptions that go into our stories and then reconstructing ones that are amended, altered, or new stories. And it's the process, the way of going about looking at how we construct our own stories. And that's the most informed, insightful way of story busting that we know. And the story may not need to be busted. It may need to be enhanced. But that's a way to look at that and a model to use for listening to what you hear with the client's evolving story and the co-constructed new story that you're engaged with the client. I'm going to go back off of the lecture to address any other questions or clarifications. Okay, other questions or thoughts that we can talk about? And we have just a couple of minutes, but I'm very interested in your thoughts. Is Gordon here, and did that answer your really excellent question you asked about story busting?
I'm here, and it was a very thorough explanation. Thank you for doing that.
Okay, great. Great. Does that, I see that you're an MBA and you do executive coaching. Does that help or apply in what you're doing?
Very much so.
Okay. Anything else that you want to add or ask from your experience? You know, when I work with a client or do a facilitation with a group, I always assume the wisdom is in the room instead of at the front of the room. And you guys don't have that experience to know that how strongly I believe in doing that with a seminar, because it's as if the wisdom is at the front of the room, which I don't believe it is. So I don't hear nearly enough from you guys. And, of course, that's always a dilemma for me, because there's so much information I want to convey. But anything you'd like to add, Gork?
Well, it was really timely for me, because I have a client now who is a partner in a staffing labor company, and he feels that he is a victim of history, and his story is, and his line that got me was, I know this has happened before and it's going to happen again. He's creating his story for separating from his partner. So some of the things you mentioned here will really be helpful when I coach him tomorrow.
Yeah. There are two principles that you might keep in mind, and we've touched on them before. And those are whatever we think and feel and experience are what we create each moment. And the second is, as adults, whatever we experience, we either accept or create. And no matter how entrenched the attachment patterns are with another person or a system or a profession or a partnership, those attachment patterns can be automatic and default if we follow the superhighway of the familiar in our brains with patterns that are already etched, or we can create a new story. Now, it's not as easy. We give up the familiar. We give up our confidence and our certainty of how things will respond and how other people will respond. But we can create new stories, even though in the beginning, it's not as easy. It's just that the only thing harder is not doing it. So, great example. Thank you. And thank you all very much. And remember, we'll pick up in 2 weeks. I'll send an email to remind. Thanks very, very much. I appreciate all your comments, your kind words, and the questions and comments you've sent.
Thank you.
Look forward to picking up with you in 2 weeks. Bye now.
Dr. Kruger?